And we appreciate you being with us on another debate. I'm Marzieh Hashemi, signing off for myself and all the crew right here in Tehran. Thanks so much for being with us.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
We draw your attention to verses 54 and 55 of chapter Araf from the Holy Quran, recited by Mr. Ali Asghar Burumand.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Inna rabbakumu Allahu alladhi khalaqa as-samawati wal-arda fi sittati ayyam. خَلَقَ السَّمَاوَاتِ وَالْأَرْضَ فِي سِتَّةِ أَيَّامٍ ثُمَّ اسْتَوَى عَلَى الْعَرْشِ الليل النهار يطلبه حثيثا والشمس والقمر والنجوم مسخرات ألا له الخلق والأمر تبارك الله رب العالمين ادعوا ربكم تضرعا ادعوا ربك لكم تضرعا وخفية إنه لا يحب المعتدين صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Surely your Lord is Allah, who created the heavens and the earth in six periods of time, and He is firm in power. He throws the veil of night over the day, which it pursues incessantly, and He created the sun and the moon and the stars, made subservient by His command. Surely His is the creation and the command. Blessed is Allah, the Lord of the worlds. Call on your Lord humbly and secretly. Surely He does not love those who exceed the limits.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
This hour's top stories. Iran holds a state funeral for its renowned nuclear scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, who was killed in a terror attack near Tehran on Friday. More international condemnations pour in following the assassination of Iran's prominent nuclear scientist. Also in the headlines, Britain says this week is very significant for Brexit as its trade talks with the EU near the deadline, while serious differences have remained unresolved. Those were the top stories. Iran has held a funeral for renowned nuclear scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, who was assassinated near Tehran on Friday. Senior government and military officials attended the event. Addressing the participants, Iranian Defense Minister Amir Khatami said assassinating Iranian scientists is an indication of the enemy's defeat. The defense minister vowed to a crushing response to the perpetrators of the attack.
That no criminality, no assassination. In fact, every criminal activity, every criminal action, every assassination will receive a response, and they should know, the perpetrators should know that they will receive a crushing response, and we will act in accordance with the order by the leader.
Khatami urged the Iranian authorities to bring to justice those who carried out the attack. Mr. Fakhrizadeh, who headed the Iranian Defense Ministry's Organization of Defensive Innovation and Research, was assassinated after his car was ambushed in the city of Absard, east of the capital, Tehran. Iranian officials say there are serious indications that the Israeli regime was behind the assassination. They have pledged to revenge the incident. More international reactions are pouring in to the assassination of Iranian nuclear scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh. The Iraqi foreign minister condemned the killing and offered condolences to the Iranian government and people. Fuad Hussein also slammed what he called actions that do not contribute to supporting stability. The head of the Russian Parliament's Foreign Affairs Committee denounced the terror attack as a crime. Leonid Slutsky said that the move is aimed at provoking Iran. The European Union blasted the killing as a criminal act. Turkey called it an act of terrorism and said its perpetrators must be held accountable. The UAE and Jordan also condemned the assassination, calling for restraint.
Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, a leading nuclear scientist, was assassinated in a terrorist attack on Friday. Iran's defense ministry said the top scientist was seriously wounded after attackers targeted his car and exchanged fire with his bodyguards in the town of Absart to the east of capital Tehran. Fakhrizadeh later died from his injuries in hospital. Fakhrizadeh was Iran's most renowned nuclear scientist who headed the Ministry of Defense's Research and Innovation Organization. His assassination prompted outrage in the country, with officials blaming Israel for the terrorist attacks and pledging retaliation. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, called for those involved in the assassination of Fakhrizadeh to be brought to justice.
It is evident terrorism has targeted the scientific progress of the Islamic world in general, and the Islamic Republic in particular. The first and foremost reason for this hostility is our development, is our progress, is our self-sufficiency, is the strength of our fists at this very moment as we shout out loud what is just and inflict upon them the truth.
And Iranian President Hassan Rouhani called Fakhrizadeh's assassination a proof of enemies' desperation.
This terrorist act indicates the enemy's failures in political fronts in the region as well as across the world. The assassination of the scientist suggests the extent of enemy's malice and garage toward Iran's scientific capabilities and achievements. The killing of figures like Fakhrizadeh will not weaken Iran's will to move toward scientific development and progress. Rather, it makes Iranians more resolute in their path.
Fakhrizadeh's name was specifically mentioned in Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's presentation about Iran's nuclear program in April 2018. At the time, Netanyahu said he identified Fakhrizadeh as the head scientist in the program and urged people to remember that name.
A key part of the plan was to form new organizations to continue the work. This is how Dr. Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, head of Project Abad, put it. Remember that name, Fakhrizadeh.
The Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif said there are, quote, serious indications of an Israeli role in the assassination. He urged the international community, especially the European Union, to end, quote, their shameful double standards and condemn the assassination of the nuclear scientist. Zarif was referring to a trial in Belgium where four Iranian diplomats were accused of plotting a bomb attack in Paris.
Several top Iranian scientists have been assassinated over the past decade. Israel has time and again been accused of carrying out those killings, although the regime has never admitted doing them. Now, as far as the assassination of Fakhrizadeh is concerned, the question is whether the U.S. is complicit in its killing, in his killing, that is, through having prior knowledge about it, for which goal? To prevent the advancement of Iran's nuclear technology. Iran says the assassination of Fakhrizadeh is yet another desperate attempt to wreak havoc in West Asia. Tehran says the killing is also an effort to disrupt Iran's scientific and technological development. Meanwhile, Iran's leader Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei has called on officials to follow up on the technical and scientific activities of Mr. Fakhrizadeh. The leader has also urged relevant authorities to mete out definitive punishment for those who ordered and perpetrated the crime.
One of the latest projects that Fakhrizadeh was involved in was the development of the first indigenous COVID-19 test kit. U.S. sanctions prevent Iran from accessing medicine and humanitarian goods during this pandemic. The top scientist was also supervising the development of a COVID-19 vaccine. Four other Iranian nuclear scientists were assassinated between 2010 and 2012, with Tehran and Western intelligence agencies blaming Israel for those killings. The Israeli terror campaign has been widely seen as a project to stymie Iran's peaceful nuclear activities, which have been under intense scrutiny of the United Nations Nuclear Agency.
Zionism, imperialism, the whole Western blood-soaked empires that assassinate, that murder, bomb, and displace, and then justify their crimes through propaganda, just like they did throughout the colonization epoch. What I believe is that wherever in the world there is oppression, there will be a struggle. And wherever in the world there is a struggle, we shall be there. And if they think that they are threatened, well, because they are the oppressors.
This assassination follows a not-so-secret meeting in Saudi Arabia between the Saudi foreign minister and Israeli prime minister last week. It sent another signal that Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman and Benjamin Netanyahu see this window as their last best chance in a while to try to inflict a crippling blow on Iran. Experts believe Riyadh and Tel Aviv are seeking to complicate an already challenging course for a new U.S. team to re-engage with Iran. The U.S. President Donald Trump abandoned the 2015 Iran deal in 2018. Since then, Washington carried out what it called a maximum pressure campaign against Iran and imposed massive sanctions against the country. But future President of the United States, Joe Biden, has pledged to re-engage with Iran when he becomes U.S. President in January, despite long-standing opposition from Israel.
Author and journalist Eric Wahlberg says the refusal of some world leaders to condemn the assassination of the Iranian nuclear scientist is reprehensible.
Oh, that's reprehensible, that every leader of every country should be outraged at this, because it's a bad portent for anyone that wants to have an independent foreign policy. It's you just have no option in the American worldview. I noticed that Germany did express concern, and I'm sure that the United Nations will denounce this as well. So I think that some of the West have taken a more reasonable position, but everyone is afraid of the United States. So it's very, very hard to stand up to the United States. And obviously, this is a provocation on Israel's part to try and provoke Iran and to muddy the waters so that Biden cannot return to the nuclear deal. So I just hope that that doesn't happen.
Well, this is the latest on that assassination that took place on Friday. It basically said that the remnants of the explosion show signs of them belonging to the Israeli armed forces. We're going to continue with the other news that we have covered for you this hour. Several European human rights envoys deplore Saudi Arabia over its continued detention of women's rights activists. European rights ambassadors have criticized the kingdom for referring the cases of two women activists to a special court for terrorism offenses. In a statement, they also urged Riyadh to release the woman, including Lujain al-Havloul, that's, I believe, and Samar Badawi. Havloul and Badawi were among many jailed activists, that should be, during a 2018 operation targeting prominent opponents of the kingdom's former law, barring women from driving. The crackdown happened on the order of Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman just weeks before the ban was lifted. A number of detainees had accused interrogators of subjecting them to torture. The Havloul family had also accused authorities of threatening to rape and kill her. British Foreign Minister Dominic Raab says the UK and the European Union are heading into a very significant week for negotiations on a post-Brexit trade deal.
I do think that this is a very significant week, the last real major week subject to any further postponement of the goalposts in terms of the timing.
Meanwhile, EU negotiator Michel Barnier describes the current talks as a, quote, ongoing process. Months of negotiations have so far failed to bridge differences on competition policy and the distribution of fishing rights. Without a deal, the $1 trillion trade between the two sides will be at risk. Britain's transitional EU exit agreement is set to expire on December 31st. London has time and again said it will not seek any extension. The office of the projected winner of the 2020 White House race says Joe Biden will receive his first presidential daily briefing on Monday. Biden has been blocked from receiving high-level intelligence briefings, mainly due to U.S. President Donald Trump's refusal to concede defeat. Trump still challenges the vote, saying it was rigged. Receiving daily briefing is a necessary part of the transition of power. The move comes after the General Services Administration said last week the transition of power could take place. Now, Palestinians have held a protest rally in a village of West Bank against Israel's decision to raze it to the ground. The rally was part of events to mark the International Day of Solidarity with the Palestinian people. Mona Kandil reports.
The International Day of Solidarity with the Palestinian people was designated by the United Nations on November 29 in 1977. The day is marked every year internationally with rallies and activities aimed at drawing attention to the struggle of the Palestinian people. This year, a protest was held in the village of Khan al-Ahmar that is under a threat again to be demolished by the Israeli military. On this day, Palestinians assured they will continue to defend their lands amid calls by the Palestine Liberation Organization to enable the Palestinians to exercise their right to self-determination and their independent state.
We are still struggling to protect our basic rights against Israeli regime violence. Meanwhile, our dream of an independent Palestinian state has not yet come true. We have come here to voice our protest against Israel's aggression. We are the real owners of these lands.
This year, however, Palestinians say they were left alone struggling the Israeli occupation and its non-stop attempts to annex more lands, mainly after some Arab states have signed normalization deals with Tel Aviv. These ties, Palestinians say, simply undermine efforts for Palestinian state. Palestinian officials stress that what they see as a symbolic international solidarity has failed to give the Palestinian people their rights, while Israel continues to occupy most of the land of historical Palestine.
Israel will not be deterred by statements of condemnation. Israel can be stopped only by popular nonviolent Palestinian struggle and boycott, divestment, sanctions against its system of apartheid. That's what we want to see. BDS, not normalization with occupation.
The UN, meanwhile, has renewed commitment to the Palestinian people. However, its Secretary General, Antonio Guterres, has cautioned that the prospects for a viable two-state solution are becoming more distant, mainly with Israel's expansion of illegal settlements, a significant spike in the demolition of Palestinian homes and structures, violence, and continued militant activity. After more than 40 years since the International Day of Solidarity with the Palestinian people was designated by the UN, Palestinian rights remain usurped and the dream of an independent Palestinian state has not yet come true. Mona Kandil, Occupied Ramallah.
The UN says the death toll from a Saturday terrorist attack in northeastern Nigeria has risen to 110. The UN says all those killed were civilians. It says many others were wounded in the attack that hit a village near the city of Maiduguri. Assailants targeted farmers on rice fields. They tied the farmers up and slit their throats. Local officials say the death toll could rise as some people are still missing. Massacre was the worst attack to hit Nigeria in recent months. President Muhammadu Buhari said the entire country was wounded by the senseless killings. No group has yet claimed responsibility, but Boko Haram Takfiri terrorists have been blamed for the massacre. Remaining in Africa, the Ethiopian government says it has launched a manhunt for Tigray leaders who were engaged in recent deadly clashes with the army. Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed said police seek to arrest what they call Tigray People's Liberation Front criminals and bring them to court. On Saturday, he said the army had taken control of Tigray's capital and military operations were over. Now, the International Committee of the Red Cross says there is an influx of wounded people in Mekelle. It says hospitals are facing shortages of food and medical supplies. Thousands of people are believed to have been killed in 3 weeks of fighting in Mekelle. Nearly 44,000 fled to neighboring Sudan. A prominent aid organization estimates that 11 million children under the age of 5 are at risk of extreme hunger or famine in 11 countries. Save the Children said the kids are facing starvation in Africa, the Caribbean, the Middle East, and Asia. The charity called on the international community to act quickly to avert the crisis. The organization called for an end to global conflict and chronic poverty. Save the Children highlighted the significance of building more resilient communities with access to adequate supplies. The aid agency made it clear that the time to act is now, as millions of children's lives are at stake. The top U.S. health expert has warned that America should prepare for a surge upon a surge in COVID-19 cases in the coming weeks. Anthony Fauci said in an interview that an uptick in coronavirus infections is inevitable following the Thanksgiving holiday travels. The same concerns have been echoed by the U.S. Surgeon General Jerome Adams. The warnings come as U.S. officials say over a million people traveled through U.S. airports last week, marking their busiest day since the pandemic began. The U.S. is the world's worst hit country by the virus, having logged over 266,000 deaths and more than 13.3 million cases. President Donald Trump's administration has been criticized for issuing conflicting messages about mask wearing, travel, and the danger posed by the virus.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
The all-merciful, the all-compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who allowed none to witness when He created the heavens and the earth, and who took no helper when He authored the spirits. He has no associate in divinity and no support in unity. Tongues fall silent before the limits of describing Him. Intellects fail before the core of knowing Him. Terrors fall low in awe of Him. Faces are humbled in fear of Him. And everything mighty yields to His mightiness. So to Thee belongs praise again and again, well measured, continually and methodically. And may His blessings be upon His messenger endlessly, and His salutation everlastingly, eternally. O Allah, make the beginning of this day of mine righteousness, its middle prosperity, and its end success. I seek refuge in Thee from a day whose beginning is fright, and whose middle is anxiety, and whose end is pain. O Allah, I pray forgiveness from Thee for every vow I have vowed, and every promise I have promised, and every pledge I have pledged, then failed to keep for Thee. I ask Thee concerning the complaints of Thy servants against me. If there is a servant from among Thy servants, of a handmaid from among Thy handmaids, who has against me a complaint, because I have wronged him in respect to himself, his reputation, his property, his wife or his child, or because evil words I have spoken about him in his absence, an imposition upon him through inclination, caprice, scorn, zeal, false show, bigotry, whether he be absent or present, alive or dead, such that my hand has fallen short and my capacity has been too narrow to make restitution to him or to annul my obligation to him, I ask Thee, O He who owns all objects of need, which are granted by His will and hastened to His desire, that Thou blessest Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, peace be upon them, and makest the one I have wronged satisfied with me in the manner that Thou willst, and givest me mercy from Thee. Forgiveness decreases Thee not, and giving injuries Thee not. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, give me on every Monday two favors from Thee: the facility to obey Thee at its beginning, and the favor of Thy forgiveness at its end. O He who is Allah, and none other than whom grants forgiveness for sins.
As humans are experiencing record job losses and economic uncertainty, robots have become a hot commodity. Multiple technology manufacturers have reported increased demand for their bots over the course of the coronavirus pandemic, from drone-like machines that can roam hallways to make deliveries and artificial intelligence-powered customer service software to increased use of self-service checkouts at supermarkets. A recent report from the World Economic Forum predicted that by 2025, the next wave of automation, turbocharged by the pandemic, will disrupt 85 million jobs globally. New jobs will be created, but businesses, governments, and workers must plan to urgently work together to implement a new vision for the global workforce. The hospitality industry, which has been one of the hardest hit by the pandemic, has seen a clear uptick in the adoption of new technology during the pandemic. Hotels are allowing guests to use kiosks to check themselves in. Apps to control the television and light switches in their room, and a few use delivery bots to send to guest rooms when they want a refreshment. We now present you an article written by Lauren Aratani. The piece is titled "Robots on Rise as Americans Experience Record Job Losses Amid Pandemic." The article has been taken from a website of the British newspaper The Guardian. Please stay with us for more of Lauren Aratani's article. They can check you in and deliver oranges to your hotel room, answer your questions about a missing package, whip up sushi, and pack up thousands of subscription boxes. And perhaps most importantly, they are completely immune to COVID-19. Whilst people have had a hard time in the coronavirus pandemic, robots are having a moment. The COVID-19 pandemic has left millions of Americans unemployed, disproportionately those in the service industries where women and people of color make up the largest share of the labor force. In October, 11 million Americans were unemployed, compared with about 6 million who were without a job during the same time last year. And as humans are experiencing record job losses and economic uncertainty, robots have become a hot commodity. Multiple technology manufacturers have reported increased demand for their bots over the course of the pandemic, from drone-like machines that can roam hallways to make deliveries and artificial intelligence-powered customer service software to increased use of self-service checkouts at supermarkets. A recent report from the World Economic Forum predicted that by 2025, the next wave of automation, turbocharged by the pandemic, will disrupt 85 million jobs globally. New jobs will be created, but businesses, governments, and workers must plan to urgently work together to implement a new vision for the global workforce. The hospitality industry in particular, which has been one of the hardest hit by the pandemic, has seen a clear uptick in the adoption of new technology during the pandemic. Hotels are allowing guests to use kiosks to check themselves in. Apps to control the television and light switches in their room, and a few use delivery bots to send guests to guest rooms when they want a refreshment. Swidler, Chief Information Officer of the Getty's Group, a hotel design and development consultancy firm, said more hotels are experimenting with new technology during the pandemic. Swidler leads the Hotel of Tomorrow, a consortium of hospitality leaders that was re-upped in the middle of the pandemic to think of ways to innovate the industry. The group came up with 5 big ideas on how the industry needs to change. And new technology, including robots, are a core part of the equation. Citing Alibaba's FlyZoo hotel that is staffed nearly entirely by technology, from check-in to room service, Ron Swidler said, "The cost of automation is coming down, the technology is getting better, and we are seeing innovation working effectively in other parts of the world that we can transfer here." While the idea of being serviced by a BB-8 look-alike in a hotel may seem strange, Swidler said permanent job losses in the industry will be a reality as hotels adopt new technologies to try to save on labor costs. It is unclear whether the increased demand for new technology has directly caused job losses during the pandemic, but a discussion paper published by the Federal Reserve Bank of Philadelphia in September found that automatable jobs, occupations that could be replaced by technology that is in development or is already available, lost 4.2 more jobs per every 100 than occupations that are less at risk of automation. According to the paper, occupations that are considered automatable include hotel desk clerks, shuttle drivers, and retail salespeople. The paper's authors raised a widely shared concern that the automation undertaken during the pandemic will be a permanent replacement for jobs. Lei Ding, senior economic advisor at the Federal Reserve Bank of Philadelphia and co-author of the paper, said, "The longer time it takes to fully control the virus, the higher the probability that the labor-saving technology will become permanent," adding, "Job losses will become permanent losses." Currently, there are only anecdotal examples of permanent job loss due to an uptick in automation brought on by the pandemic. But the layoffs of hundreds of Pennsylvania toll booth workers provides one clear example of how labor-saving technology can sweep away jobs. In June, the Pennsylvania Turnpike Commission laid off about 500 toll collectors in the state when it switched to an all-electronic toll collecting. For years, the commission had talked about replacing toll booth workers with automated collectors, and they finally gave workers a timeline. Per a union agreement, workers were supposed to be kept on payroll until at least October of 2021, with final layoffs happening by January of 2022. When the pandemic arrived, collectors were sent home in March and were promised that the commission would still uphold the October 2021 date. But in June, the commission permanently laid off all of the workers over a year before the agreed date. Chuck Rowe, principal officer for Teamsters Local 77, the union representing 300 of the laid-off toll workers, said, "We understand the safety of employees is the most important thing, but for them to have safety mean the elimination of their jobs. It's been devastating." Jock Rowe cited other toll collecting agencies that brought back toll workers with enhanced safety measures, including the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey. The impact of a recession on the growth of automation has been well documented by economists and has shown that automation does not grow steadily, but rather happens in bursts. Businesses are more likely to automate after experiencing economic shocks when they have strong incentives to save on labor costs. For a study published in 2016, researchers from the University of Rochester in New York combed through 87 million job postings online from before and after the Great Recession. They found that employers in cities that were hit hardest by the recession were replacing workers with labor-saving technology and more skilled workers. A report published by the Century Foundation found that the robot intensity increased in 2009 in the immediate wake of the Great Recession, particularly in the manufacturing industry. While an increase in automation can be good for educated workers and help to stimulate the economy, studies have also shown that new technology tends to leave low-wage workers behind. Darren Acemoglu, an economist at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, said, "Automation has been a major driver in the increase in inequality." Acemoglu, co-authored a study published in May that showed automation creates a prosperity gap that benefits high-skilled workers at the sake of low-skilled workers. Low-wage workers are not only more susceptible to job losses and wage depression due to automation, but they also experience the most job losses due to shutdowns. Higher-wage workers are more likely to be able to work from home during the pandemic, while lower-wage workers, a disproportionate number of them are Black or Hispanic, were more susceptible to layoffs due to shutdown orders. Caveat many roboticists will point out is that artificial intelligence or AI technology is not quite smart enough yet to cause mass waves of layoffs due to robots. New artificial intelligence technology can take a lot of money, a lot of time and resources to set up, something that many businesses do not have during the pandemic. Matt Bean, an assistant professor at the University of Santa Barbara's Technology Management Program, said, "You should definitely not worry about losing your job to an artificial intelligence-enabled robot right now. If you're going to lose your job to automation, it's going to be some proven, well-known automation that is more than 10 to 15 years old." Acemoglu said, "Artificial intelligence has tremendous potential for making humans more productive without replacing humans. If society takes a human-centric approach to technological advances. But without the political will to make sure those who do lose jobs are taken care of by training them for new jobs, for example, the impact of automation can be devastating, and a pandemic that has already hit those workers hardest could leave a lasting legacy of unemployment. Asimoglu said, "I'm not saying automation is terrible. What I'm saying is that it would be terrible if we put all the eggs in the automation basket." He added, "We have, to a large extent, done so over the last 30 years. The pandemic will just exacerbate that."
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
Economic divide.
The U.S. economy is not doing well. So are the economies of many countries across the globe. So what makes the U.S. different? Well, aside from having the highest infection rate in the world, it may have a new president. Incoming President-elect Joe Biden, if confirmed, as reported by the media.
As I said on Saturday, I'm humbled by the trust and confidence the American people have placed in me and in Vice President-elect Harris. And we're ready to get to work addressing the needs of the American people. Today, that work begins. It starts with doing everything possible to get the COVID-19 under control.
Yeah, key word there, control. But will Biden and his team be able to deal with a problem that is so severe, a problem that has just ravaged the U.S.? One of the consequences, hunger. Check this out. This is what's going on at an L.A. food center.
Pre-pandemic, we measure things in pounds, and we were distributing about 1.5 million pounds every week in and out of our distribution centers. And now we're running at 4 million pounds a week coming in and out of our distribution centers here in South LA and Commerce.
Hello, welcome to Economic Divide with me, Kabatahwe. In this week's episode, we will take a look at the U.S. economy, how on earth it can climb out of the economic downturn, mainly due to the COVID-19 pandemic, and whether the current U.S. president or the incoming president-elect, as reported by the media, have a game plan to tackle this monumental challenge. Now, first, let's take a look at President-elect Joe Biden. He has said that business and labor leaders have signaled willingness to operate to fix the U.S. economy. He also stressed that the coronavirus first must be brought under control. He said more people would die if President Donald Trump continues blocking a U.S. transition of power. The incoming president-elect also urged Congress to pass relief legislation. As of the recording of this program, no relief deal in sight, as crucial pandemic relief programs are due to be shut down by the end of the year. Now, U.S. Congress needs to act fast. For the first week of November, this is a reason why they need to act fast. The U.S. has registered a total of 742,000 new applications for unemployment compensation. Now, that means tens of millions of Americans are out of work. Now, how is the incoming U.S. administration, once confirmed, be able to bring back these jobs?
Mm-hmm.
American voters did not elect Joe Biden because they thought that he would be the best man to revive the economy. The economy may well define his presidency nonetheless. Biden will take office in January amid a crisis brought about by the pandemic, which is capable of causing immensely more economic harm before vaccination is widespread. He will also inherit a business landscape in the throes of a once-in-a-generation shift, as technology becomes more embedded in everyday life and in more industries, a shift that has been simultaneously hastened and overshadowed by the disease.
Biden's program is very, very well targeted to be able to reverse the economic downturn, because what it involves is a lot of spending at the local level to improve infrastructure, to change the mixture of sources of energy, to provide for local social services, to attend to the health problem, and to reinstate programs for worker welfare.
Whether Biden succeeds or fails depends on how he manages these twin sources of change. Make no mistake, it is not like the U.S. president-elect lacks experience dealing with economic woes. When he became the vice president of Barack Obama in 2009, it was the depth of the Great Recession, with the U.S. economy having lost nearly 3.6 million jobs the prior year and still shedding jobs at a rate of 800,000 a month. But the U.S. economy now faces different challenges than in 2009.
The basic question here is, how bad is the U.S. economy doing? I mean, it's very simple to see that if we were to break down the numbers in the different economic sectors that show the depth of the crisis. For starters, the unemployment numbers. It is estimated that over 30 million Americans may have lost their jobs. Now add to that the millions of workers who were out of the jobs or out of their jobs before the pandemic, that number could creep up to 40 million easily. Keep in mind, many unemployed have given up work and are not being recorded. Then comes the poverty rate. The official poverty rate in the U.S. was registered at around 10% for the year 2019, before the pandemic hit. Now, when the $600 a week bonus unemployment payments stopped, poverty rates actually increased. Latest figures indicate about 7 million people are now living below the poverty line. Again, keep in mind the variance, since many are not being reported. And finally, what about economic growth? At one point, the U.S. GDP dropped in 2020, in the second quarter, that is, was the worst in its modern history. It was down 32.9%. That being the largest quarterly drop since the Great Depression. And since then, the U.S. has regained just two-thirds of that figure.
Biden has repeatedly said that before America could rebuild its battered economy, it needed to get the virus under control.
COVID, it's a terrible disaster. The United States right now is the largest loci for infections, and now has surpassed 250,000 deaths.
The coronavirus has affected almost every country around the world. Many have taken an economic hit this year as a result. However, while citizens of other countries generally agree on how to move forward, Americans have a wide ideological divide that could make Biden's job much harder, as presidents often draw on public support to help push their agendas forward.
Economic recovery, his view of economic recovery is a recovery that's based upon doing something at the very, very grassroots level. And that's extraordinarily important to reverse the kind of top-down corporate subsidies, corporate welfare that the Trump administration offered.
A survey conducted over the summer found that among citizens of economically advanced countries struggling to contain the virus, Americans were the most polarized along party lines in their assessments of the government's response to the virus and the economy. Furthermore, another poll from October revealed that only 24% of Trump supporters said that the coronavirus outbreak was very important to their vote, compared to 82% of Biden supporters. Conversely, 84% of Trump supporters said that the economy was very important, versus 66% of Biden supporters. Biden has promised to follow the advice of public health advisors, even if they recommend shutting down businesses. Biden's supporters may applaud that approach, but he will find it challenging to convince the rest of the country that it's the right way to go, especially Trump's most ardent loyalists, many of whom have shunned even basic preventative measures like masks. The congressional situation is a major obstacle for Biden's agenda as well. The U.S. president-elect may get only parts of his broad plans spanning everything from child care to infrastructure to climate change through a gridlocked Congress.
Okay, joining us in the studio today is Craig Holman. PhD serves as a Public Citizens Capitol Hill lobbyist on ethics, lobbying, and campaign finance rules. Now, Craig is an expert on campaign finance reform, governmental ethics, lobbying practices, and the impact of money in politics. Previously, he was senior policy analyst at the Brennan Center for Justice, New York University School of Law. Craig, welcome to Economic Divide. The U.S. President Donald Trump's economic plans were deemed a success before COVID-19. But right now, we're looking at a massive economic devastation. For example, unemployment at an all-time high, pretty much. Business bankruptcies also at an all-time high. Increasing poverty. President-elect Biden, once confirmed, has focused on spending with a lockdown to incur beforehand. Do you think he's going to be able to jumpstart the economy?
Biden's going to make every effort at jumpstarting the economy. And I suspect when it comes to the COVID-19 pandemic, he will succeed on this. Biden has laid out his plans, first things first, and that is number one on his priority.
Okay. You say disastrous Trump administration. Biden has focused on four major areas to transform the U.S. economy: COVID-19, economic recovery, racial equity, and climate change. Are those four areas going to work?
Well, there's his whole program is different than what we've seen with the Trump administration. Biden has laid out his economic plans through the course of the campaign. At first, he's going to focus on working class interests, which, by the way, is an absolute reversal from the Trump administration. Trump has favored the very wealthy. He's given tax cuts to the wealthy, tax cuts to the corporations. Biden plans on reversing those tax cuts to the wealthy.
Okay, you apparently are very pro-Trump, but I'm going to play devil's advocate. Are you looking at Biden's economic initiatives in which the transition team says it wants to mobilize American manufacturing and innovation and build a modern infrastructure for clean energy?
I was mentioning that one of Biden's priorities is infrastructural development, and that includes energy along with roads and bridges and the entire infrastructure that makes the economy operate. Biden has pledged so far to spend about $1 trillion on developing the infrastructure for the U.S. economy over a period of about 10 years. That's going to have to be negotiated once again with the Republican Senate. So whether he gets to go that far, it remains to be seen. But that is going to be the new emphasis coming out of the White House.
And finally, how do you think the U.S. is going to be able to offset China's economic influence globally and its penetration into U.S. markets when China is already ahead in its post-COVID-19 period, all the numbers say so, while the U.S. is still grappling with the COVID-19?
There are two different questions in there. First of all, this is something Biden can do pretty much on his own. We've seen Trump alienate our international colleagues, literally lock out of any kind of negotiations, countries like Iran or China. And Biden is not of that ilk. Biden wants to work with our international colleagues. He wants to open up relations and communications with countries like Iran and China. And so we're going to see a big change. And Biden can do that on his own as the executive. He doesn't need congressional approval on a lot of this. So we are going to see changes there.
Okay, thank you very much for that. That's Craig Holman, Public Citizens Capitol Hill lobbyist, with his statements there. Obviously, very Crow. Biden, again, once Biden gets elected, or confirmed, I should say. Well, it's time for a quick break here on Economic Divide, but don't go anywhere. We have plenty more coming up in the next half of the program. Welcome back to Economic Divide with Mika Watawe. In this in-depth section, we are going to put the current Treasury Secretary, Steven Mnuchin, under the spotlight. Why? Well, it first started with this headline. Paul Krugman, he's a famous economist, slammed the Trump administration plot to sabotage the economy and hurt Biden. The article said that, unfortunately, a decision made by Mnuchin, according to the New York Times, won't make it any easier for Biden to handle the economy. Well, let's go to the source, the New York Times. Now, this is what the headline stated, Mnuchin's inglorious endgame. And the New York Times couldn't be more blunt than this. Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin is spending his last few months in office trying to undermine President-elect Joe Biden and the American economy. How is Mnuchin going about this? Well, the Trump administration is reportedly abruptly curtailing the Federal Reserve's emergency lending programs. These are safety net programs that Americans rely on during these desperate times. Here is what Paul McCulley, former PIMCO chief, economist, and senior fellow at Cornell University, said about the Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin's decision in his appearance on CNBC.
You said you don't buy the fact that there wasn't a political flavor here. What do you mean by that, Paul? You think this was a deliberate attempt to sabotage President-elect Biden's economic tools?
I don't think it was a deliberate attempt to do so, but certainly they didn't have to do it now. And actually, they limited to a degree the optionality or flexibility that the new Treasury Secretary would have. So that's what I mean by political, because a good, peaceful, smooth transition shouldn't be throwing sand into your successor's job. And I think that's what he did. So that's why I mean it had a flavor of a political action.
The unemployment crisis is yet another challenge on the path of the incoming U.S. president. The overall U.S. unemployment rate is currently 6.9%. which, while better than April's 14.7%, still means that 10 million pre-pandemic jobs are lost.
The real problem of reinvigorating industry in the United States is trying to figure out how to get small and medium-sized enterprises to restart, to go back on the track. Because, in fact, it is the small and medium-sized industries that create most of the jobs, most of the opportunities, and have much of the opportunity for innovation, both in the environment and in a better quality of life.
Analysts say people who have been unemployed for 6 months or more are about twice as likely to drop out of the labor force as to find employment. Additionally, the longer a person is out of work, the less consumer purchasing they do, which further slows economic growth. Data shows that long-term unemployment as a share of all unemployment is growing fast across the U.S. In October, 3.6 million of the 11 million unemployed Americans had been out of work for 6 months or longer. That's a ratio that is not seen since mid-2014, when Biden was the country's vice president, and the unemployment rate, like today, surpassed 6%. The continuing unemployment crisis has led economists to become increasingly pessimistic about when the country might return to pre-pandemic levels. Business and academic economists surveyed by the Wall Street Journal in April predicted that the labor market would recover by 2022. But when surveyed again in October, 55% had extended the recovery forecast to the year 2023 or later.
Time now to bring in Atifa Pattydar. She's our researcher and journalist, and she joins us now to tell us more about the state of the U.S. economy. Welcome. So this time around, you're not only going to share with us your media posts, but you were also the writer of this program, so that's obviously right. You have a lot to say.
Yeah, well, I took to the social media because obviously Americans on social media, as I found out, are as divided as they are outside social media on whether Biden is the right guy for reviving the economy and salvaging the country from the pandemic. Well, there are a lot of guys who think that since Biden was the vice president of Obama and did the great job back in 2009 after the Great Recession, and Biden helped Obama to revive the economy and create jobs, so he's the man for the job. They think that he can do this. But, you know, this is a total different situation because that was something about mortgage, and that recession was not due to the pandemic. We have to see if Biden can do this. A pro-Trump account is saying that Biden supported trade, the working economy, world peace, and low unemployment rate for a guy who just not Trump. You're all pointing it retarded. Sorry for that last word.
No, that's okay.
Yeah, well, they're saying that things are already good. Why we have to bring another guy that we don't know if he has a plan or not? A lot of them are saying that Biden is going to let China take over the world economy. As we know, China at the moment is the second biggest economy in the world, and they are the U.S. biggest rival. So they're saying that Biden is not the man for the job.
Okay, if he gets to confirm that. Thank you so much for that. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Of course. Thank you. I'll talk to you there about the state of the U.S. economy and the social media post. All right. We couldn't cover the U.S. economy without talking about the unemployment situation. As usual, there's